It is not hard to destroy a college.
Last season, the podcast Campus Files brought you stories of fraternity drug rings, stolen body parts, campus cults, and more.
And now Campus Files is back for another season.
There's a guy screaming into his phone. He's like, I just saw Charlie Kirk get assassinated right in front of me.
Every week is a new episode and a new story.
It was so chaotic.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 28 degrees out there. Let's see if I remember how to do this. Been a while. Great to see Jonathan Lowe, our studio coordinator, producer. How are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Just kind of hanging in there. I have had a few Sunday or Saturdays off because of sports, and then I took some for personal reasons. I'm taking next Saturday off as well, but it's great to be here. There's certainly a lot to talk about. We've got a great show lined up for you. Coming up in a few minutes, we're talking with a young woman. She is a high school student who has basically set up a system and a group that is combating opioid addiction and promoting opioid awareness amongst young people in her community. And I think that this is something that's really important throughout the state of Minnesota. So she's going to join us. And then later this hour, we're going to talk with the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association about that huge gift from Bill Gates for Alzheimer's research. And where do we stand right now? It's not like we don't have any Alzheimer's research right now, but we're going to talk about the advances, what people should know, where people can get help, all of those things. It's such a crippling and devastating disease. And I think it's very important that we get, you know, as much awareness as we can. This group does a wonderful job. I've talked to them before. And I just thought it was important to have them on in light of this gift to really look at what might happen with this kind of a gift, but also what's happening right now, because I know that there are some really amazing, amazing research efforts here, right here in the state of Minnesota with the University of Minnesota, with the Mayo Clinic. So we wanted to get an update on that. In the 7 o'clock hour, we will have Nancy Dahl on her new book, Grounded. She's the first woman president of Life Touch. And she has written a very interesting book, so we're going to visit with her on that. We've got an expert on ISIS. And then 8 o'clock, we are going to chat with Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. Obviously, a lot going on politically, as there seems to always be going on, but certainly this issue of sexual harassment that has seemed to touch every corner of our nation, including the state capitol in St. Paul. Certainly, Senator Al Franken, also being accused of sexual misconduct. We're going to talk to Professor David Schultz about that and the implications for that. What happens next? What happens next with Senator Franken? Some people have actually called for him to resign or step down. So we'll visit with him about that. So a lot going on. It is great to be with you here on News Radio 830 WCCO after a few weeks off. Let's take a quick break, and then we're going to be joined by student Elizabeth Johnson on her initiative and the initiative of other young people in her community to try and combat opioid addiction. It is 6:17, Esme Murphy with you on a Saturday evening. Certainly the issue of opioid addiction and opioid abuse and overdoses is something that is not confined to the Twin Cities. It is a nationwide epidemic that is hitting all of our communities, including smaller cities, including rural areas, all over our state, and as I said, all over our nation. Well, up in Little Falls, some high school students have come up with an effort to try and raise awareness and combat this epidemic, which obviously is hitting people who are their own age. Elizabeth Johnson is joining me right now, and she's going to tell us about this effort. Elizabeth, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, why don't you tell our listeners, you know, who you are and how some of your friends and your fellow students came up with this program that you're trying to implement.
So I'm a student. I'm a junior at Little Falls Community High School, and we have what's called DECA, which is an organization, and it's dedicated to emerging leaders and entrepreneurs in management, finance, hospitality, marketing, and other terms of in that sort. And so they have what's called the Public Relations Project, which is part of getting our DECA members as well as our students involved with our community. And so we decided that we wanted to run an opioid awareness program because you look at the statistics and it's huge. It's
and let me ask you, and it is huge, and the alarming thing is that it's growing so rapidly. Have you, as a community in high school, I mean, do you know people it's affected?
Definitely, yeah.
Even people your age, young as you were. Okay, and that's just so sad. I mean, at any level, it's devastating. But when you hear about it affecting young people, it's just especially troubling. So tell us about the effort that you're organizing.
So when we saw this, when we saw statistics, it showed from our three pharmacies in Little Falls that we have a population of just over 8,000. 100,000 narcotic pills were leaving our pharmacies a month. Not a year, but in a month.
Wow.
And so...
This is just in Little Falls?
In just our three pharmacies in Little Falls, yes.
Wow. Okay.
And so Corinna Brozy, she's my business partner here for this project, we decided we wanted to run an Opioid Awareness Month, which will be happening January 2017. And then also at the end of that month, we will have an Awareness Week that will go throughout our high school as kind of a grand finale for the month.
And I know that you're working with medical professionals up there, right?
Yes. We're fortunate enough to have Dr. Heather Bell and Dr. Kurt Devine in our town who have been addressing this issue already to help.
Right. And I believe I ran into them at the Steve Rummler Hope Foundation as well, which is a wonderful organization that tries to promote awareness around the state. What in terms of is your focus going to be the entire community, or are you going to have a particular focus on younger people?
For our project, we're hoping, for now, we're going to stay more on the younger people.
Okay.
And then we hope to continue this project throughout and hopefully get a larger outreach. But for now, it's mostly young adults, yeah.
Okay. And what are some of the things you've learned as you've kind of gotten into this and sort of studied this a little bit?
The rates of prescriptions have just gone through the roof, and that's a huge thing that needs to be addressed. As well as kids were very naive kind of to the problem that's going on. And for me, I guess, I didn't really even know that this problem was there until I saw statistics and I saw stuff on the news. And I don't think many people realize that this is truly happening in our own communities right here at home.
Right. And I also think too, because I wonder, and I've done a lot of work and done a lot of stories on this for both TV and radio. And so I've been very, much aware of it. I've had, people like the folks from the Steve Rummler Hope Foundation kind of come pounding down my door and calling me up and, trying to get press releases on for years to raise awareness. And I think they've done such a great job. So I was pretty aware, but I have teenagers, high school students. I'm a parent of two high school students, and I was a little surprised last year when one of them had to have a relatively minor operation. I mean, he was knocked out, but I was really startled that we were given a large, bottle or prescribed a large bottle of opioids. And I was just like, oh gosh, this is kind of scary. And they said, well, one every 8 hours is needed for pain. And, I was able eventually to give my child, some Advil, and that was fine. But have you heard of kids getting these prescriptions when they go in for, maybe it's an injury for football or, volleyball or something like that?
Yes. I mean, even me, I've had two knee surgeries in the past 2 or 3 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And yes, the prescriptions that we get are, even just as a child, I'm 16 years old and I'm getting these, they've got huge prescriptions that were not needed. It's excessive.
Right. And were you told, or do you remember, because you probably were a little out of it when you got the prescriptions, but were your parents or guardians ever told, hey, listen, this is something that is dangerous. If she doesn't need it, just, give her Advil or something like that?
No, I don't. Not that I am aware of. I mean, I think it was just kind of take this as your pain needs, and that was pretty much the end of it.
Right. See, and that's something where I think I think that really how physicians are handling this or pharmacists, I do think that there needs to be that education for them, because I think when you get this prescription, you think, oh, here it is, and this is something I'm supposed to use, and I think that part is very troubling. I'd really like to see that part stepped up. Everywhere. But in terms of the high school, has the high school been supportive of this effort?
Yes, very much so. Our principal and our this advisors for our DECA have been great in helping us and setting up times throughout the high school day that we can come in. And we're also going to hold a community forum event, so our principal has been great with helping us set that up and get times organized.
All right. It also sounds like the hospital up there is really working as well. They've gotten some funding. Do you have any details about that or the kinds of efforts that they're trying to do?
I have a little. Yeah, they have the hospital here is doing a phenomenal job at working on the crisis that is happening. And I know the doctors and some of their other task force members and people helping them have gone to Washington, D.C. and spoke, I think, twice about their efforts. And a lot of what they're doing, I think, is talking to other hospitals and to other physicians about prescribing. That's a huge thing.
All right. We're chatting with Elizabeth Johnson. She's a high school student who is organizing an effort in her community to raise awareness about opioid overdoses and opioid addiction. Let me ask you, Elizabeth, we've been talking mostly about prescription medications. One of the things that really has emerged in the past few years are these synthetic opioids, the ones that are manufactured mostly in China that are available through mail order. Is that something that has that hit Little Falls? Because it has been a desperate problem here in the Twin Cities. And if so, are you going to include that as part of your awareness efforts?
Those drugs specifically, I haven't really worked with them specifically. It's more of an overall opioid class of the drugs. But I do know that it's just being hit hard here overall. And so that synthetic opioids are definitely part of our project, as they have been huge all over for death rates and everything.
Right, because what's so desperate about these drugs is fentanyl and carfentanil. They're so deadly, and in fact, they're even warning paramedics. If they even touch it, they could potentially die. So it's that devastating. Is there? So you're focusing on opioids. Is there sort of because I think most high schools or most communities have sort of, whether it's a drug or alcohol awareness for young people. Is that something that already exists up in Little Falls?
Like a program?
Yes,
we have what's called Target, and so students can join Target, and that's all about the living sober, living drug-free, and promoting that within our schools. And they go to the middle school and to the elementary schools. And so, yeah, we do have that.
Right, and because that's something that's so important. How many young people, is it just you and your partner that are working with this, to try and get the word out, or Corinna, or are there other kids involved in it as well?
Corinna and I are the project chairs, the managers, but we are involving our entire chapter, which as of now is about 30 members.
Oh, okay. And what kinds of specific things do you think you'll be doing in January?
So at the beginning of the month, we're going to hang red ribbons on the light post to signify the drug awareness, because that's the drug awareness color. And then we also hope to do an open mic, which is going – we're showcase some poetry that people have written, whether they're an addict, whether they're in recovery, whether they've loved an addict and lost somebody, things like that. And then we also are going to have an essay contest revolving around the same type of thing, or people, like loving an addict or been an addict themselves, things like that. And then there will be a prize at the end of that. But then our biggest event in January is going to be our community forum event, which will be at the end of Opioid Awareness Week. And we are going to have hopefully two testimonials about how they've lived with it and how they're recovering now and what it's like living as an addict. And then also the police department will talk, and we hope to have one of our doctors, Dr. Heather Bell or Kurt Devine, talk about what they're doing and how it's affecting people in the community and even at the hospital.
Okay, yeah, and it's certainly I was recently interviewing a paramedic who said, like, in the past 2 or 3 years, he's personally reversed, and this is in Hennepin County, I think 38 opioid overdoses. I mean, and I'm sure it's that big a problem up there as well. Well, listen, Elizabeth Johnson, thank you so much for coming on. We'll have to visit with you in January to see how this project is going.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. All right, that's Elizabeth Johnson. She is a Little Falls Community High School student. She is organizing an effort to combat opioid addiction, promote opioid awareness in her community. Thank you so much. All right, folks, I got a lot more ahead. We are going to take a little break, give you some weather. It's a little brisk out there, but then again, it is the season. I mean, Thanksgiving right around the corner, obviously. And then we are going to visit with the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association about that big gift from Bill Gates and the impact of that. And but also, what is the existing status of research here? Because I know that there has been so much of an effort here. You know, already so much money has been put in to trying to, you know, research and find the cure for these kinds of diseases. So we're going to visit with her about that. But first, we need to take a break, and we'll give you some weather. Keep it here. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO. Well, a lot of news this week, a lot of news, but something that happened earlier in the week, which I thought was really remarkable, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation announcing that they are investing $100 million towards Alzheimer's research. Half will go to the Dementia Discovery Fund, a venture capital effort that includes philanthropic government and pharmaceutical partners. The other half to Alzheimer's additional research. Sue Spalding, the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, kind enough to join us now. Sue, thank you so much for coming on WCCO.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. Let me ask you, what does this mean? I mean, what could this bring to the table with this kind of investment?
Well, the first thing, and probably one of the biggest things it does, is really bring awareness of Alzheimer's disease and the urgency that we need to find treatments and a cure. Just like you said, the publicity that we have received, the Alzheimer's Association and Alzheimer's disease this week has been phenomenal. And it just raises that level of concern for everybody that, hey, this is really important and we need to do something about it.
And in terms of, you know, putting some of it into dementia, I mean, first of all, why don't you explain, people hear Alzheimer's, they hear dementia, what should they know?
Well, dementia is the overarching term for the disease, and it's really kind of about the symptoms. And then Alzheimer's is the specific disease name. So think about, like, if you said, I have cancer, then somebody would say, well, what form of cancer do you have? So it's the same with dementia. I have dementia. What form of dementia do I have? And there are 50 different forms of dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the one that most people have. So 70% of people with dementia have Alzheimer's disease.
All right. Now, you know, one of the things we were talking about this when this this news broke in our newsroom, and you know, one of my colleagues said, well, you can't really be diagnosed with dementia, or excuse me, Alzheimer's until you die. And so I thought, really? You know, I thought, well, I thought there were millions of people, including many that I know, who are diagnosed with it. And then I kind of looked it up and said, I guess, is it the case that the definitive end cause diagnosis can only be done at death?
Well, that used to be true. But within the last 5 years, we've been able to develop PET scans that actually can see the brain and see the changes in the brain and can see the buildup of the plaques and the tangles. So we can now diagnose Alzheimer's disease before someone dies. But yes, that used to be true, to have that, you know, definitive, hey, this is what you had. It had to be at autopsy. But with advancements, because of funding from the Alzheimer's Association, that's no longer true.
Okay, so that is considered definitive, those PET scans?
Yes.
Okay, and tell us what you just described, that what these PET scans, first of all, what is a PET scan, and what is it that these PET scans are picking up?
Well, it's similar to like an MRI, and they would do those too when they're trying to diagnose the disease. And what it actually is looking at is the brain. So it's going to take images of your brain, and it can see in areas if there are areas that are shrinking and actually changing. And then they're able to see the buildup of the protein. So they're actually seeing the plaques and the tangles that are building up within a person's brain and basically clogging the system so you can't get the signals through.
All right. So literally, you can go in there and see parts of the brain shrinking, and then you can see this other stuff there that's interfering.
Correct.
With it. And this is through the PET scans. You know, you hear about the research that this is going to be able to fund, this gift from the Gates Foundation. But in terms of research, in terms of breakthroughs, have there been any, you know, that are significant? Certainly that would be one, you know, the PET scan, being able to significantly do it. But have there been others recently? And are there things that you know, you look out and think about and think, gosh, this is really, this could be it, or that this can help delay, you know, the onset of some mm-hmm. of the more severe symptoms?
Well, definitely the PET scan and the development of that has changed how we diagnose and how we do research. One of the biggest things that it can do, and I think this is one of the most exciting things that's happened recently, is that it really, we're able to then look and see, are we targeting the correct drugs and are we targeting the right people? You know, I heard one of our doctors from the Mayo Clinic talk the other, a couple weeks ago, and he said, you know, we used to try to get rid of the amyloid, and we had all these drugs to get rid of amyloid, but then we found out the people we were targeting didn't actually have amyloid.
And what is amyloid here?
Amyloid is one of the proteins that builds up in the brain that causes the plaques and tangles.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're trying to give somebody a drug that they don't actually have that part of the disease, it's not going to work. So I think that the development of these PET scans is really going to help us target the correct people with the correct drugs.
All right.
And one of the things the Alzheimer's Association does each year is holds a big international research conference. And I came back from that in July. And what I found amazing about that is there were 5,000 scientists from all over the world working on this. And, you know, all levels of different kinds of things that they were studying. But it was exciting to see that this many people care about this disease and want to make a difference. And I think some of the biggest things that are coming out of that is there's some real promise about finding a blood test so that we could diagnose the disease much earlier and much more less invasive. I mean, the problem with a PET scan is it's expensive. So it's not something that you're going to go in and get every year. It's usually then you're diagnosing it after the symptoms have come around.
Okay.
They're also looking at a lot of things about lifestyle and how our lifestyle can impact or delay the onset of the disease. They can't say it yet, like, hey, if you do all these things, you can delay the onset. But there are some real promising studies that show if you exercise, you keep your brain engaged, you eat right, get enough sleep, you know, don't smoke, that these things can, what they're really doing is kind of slowing the aging process and then slowing the aging process of your brain.
All right. Let me ask you, there's a clinic at the University of Minnesota that's aimed at heart disease that you can go to, and they submit you go through like a battery of tests. Frank Fasolaro recently did this, you know, for WCCO-TV. My husband did it as well. And they can kind of predict, just judging by looking at the heart and a bunch of other things, whether or not you really are likely to develop heart disease. And they feel that they've been mm-hmm. pretty accurate about that. Is there anything like that now for Alzheimer's where you could take somebody who is, you know, in their 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s, put them through a battery of tests and say, yep, you're going to get Alzheimer's here in a few years?
I don't think we're to that point yet. Now, there are certain forms of Alzheimer's disease that are genetic and are hereditary. So if you went through and did all of the, looked at all your genes, and if you found that you had the mutations of a couple specific genes, it really increases your risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. And some of them, it's pretty definitive that, yes, you will get it. It's just a matter of when. But that, I would say, is one of the things that we're looking at also for Alzheimer's disease. You know, how can we predict who's going to get it? And I think that's one of the things Mr. Gates was really talking about, is helping us to determine that so that we can hopefully make lifestyle interventions or find drugs to do interventions earlier so that we can slow the progression of the disease down.
All right. And because certainly, and the statistics about how many people will be living with some form of dementia in a number of years are really mind-boggling, because, you know, the aging population, we are an aging population, and more of us are going to be older here soon.
Yeah, it's frightening. Now, exciting about that is because we are no longer dying of heart disease and stroke and cancers in the numbers that we used to, because we've put a lot of money into research and have found treatments and ways to prevent all of those diseases. So that's really our hope for Alzheimer's disease. And the Alzheimer's Association has been advocating for more research funding through the National Institutes of Health for a number of years. And in the last 5 years, our funding there has almost tripled because of our efforts. So that's exciting, because we're getting about to that level where when they were funding at that $2 billion mark for cancer and for heart disease, they really made some inroads and found some treatments and prevention methods. And we're almost there with Alzheimer's disease. So we're hopeful that in the next 5 years we'll have some real more breakthroughs like you were talking about.
All right. So in other words, and I should say that we are chatting with Sue Spaulding, who's the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. It also sounds sort of like what you're saying is that because we've had so many remarkable advances in some of these other ailments like heart disease, you've got more people living longer and they're developing some form of dementia, including Alzheimer's.
Correct.
Rome.
I know.
One of the downsides. And certainly I would think that that is the case. And I do think it's the case here in Minnesota, because I think we really are so fortunate here. We have really great medical care and amazing facilities that I do think are helping people live longer. And I think also statistically, a lot of sort of the German Scandinavian stock here does live longer to start with, even without the remarkable medical care. Let me ask you, in terms of the targeted research dollars, has there been any kind of breakdown about where some of this money will go specifically? Will it go to research that's already underway, perhaps even here in Minnesota or in the upper Midwest, or has that not been disclosed yet?
Are you talking about the Gates,
yes,
the Gates money? So that I don't believe has been disclosed yet. But one of the things I heard him on a radio interview this week talk about was he was willing to be more risky with his dollars and do more startups or, you know, work in areas that maybe the federal government's not able to go towards. And even an association like ours, you know, with donor dollars, we're very cautious and want to make sure that we're following the correct paths and, you know, building upon the research that we already know, but that he, as an individual, can be more willing to take risks. And I think that's kind of exciting, that he will be able to try things that maybe we wouldn't be able to.
Okay, well, that's kind of cool, because, you know, we all would be respectful for somebody like you who's, you know, with the Alzheimer's Association, that you wouldn't want to go off on a tangent that might be too risky, because a lot of individuals have given to you probably in smaller donations, mm-hmm, and you want to be respectful of that and be a good steward of that money. So that's certainly, I think, something that we would expect from you. We do, Sue, have to take a quick little break. When we come back, I just like to ask you about some of the warning signs, some of the things you'd like people to know about what you do. What kind of help is out there for caregivers as well? Because I think that is such a big part of this. So can you stick around for just a little bit?
Sure, absolutely.
Sue Spaulding, folks, the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. More with Sue after this on News Radio 830 WCCO. It is 6:49 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy, I'm chatting with Sue Spaulding, the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, about that enormous gift from Bill Gates, Bill and Melinda Gates, their foundation, $100 million devoted to dementia and Alzheimer's research. Sue, let me ask you, first of all, what help is available for caregivers right now? Because I know this is a situation in my own family, and I know many other families are struggling with this. This is really, really tough stuff.
It is. And Alzheimer's disease can be a really long journey. So one of the things we really recommend is don't try to do this journey on your own. There is a lot of help and support out there. And the first thing I would say to do is call the Alzheimer's Association, use their 24/7 helpline. Obviously answer 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, but we have licensed social workers and clinical social workers that answer that phone that can help you with anything from, hey, I'm just wondering, you know, about the symptoms, I'm wondering where a support group might be, to really challenging things like, okay, my spouse or my loved one is having behavior changes, how do I deal with this, or I'm having problems communicating with somebody. So that's really your first key to getting in, and our people will be able to help walk you through questions that you might need to ask and things you might need to know. We also can do care consultations with an entire family, and it doesn't mean the entire family has to be right here in Minnesota or North Dakota. We've done care consultations where family, you know, siblings, children are across the country, and we can teleconference everybody in and talk about how a person's going to live with this disease and set a care plan. I think planning for the future is one of the biggest things that caregivers need to do, because if you wait until something changes or it's a crisis, then it's really difficult and hard to address. But if you're always trying to think ahead, that's really helpful. And that's where the Alzheimer's Association can come in.
And what if you are at that crisis standpoint? Because I think a lot of people, it's difficult to plan because they don't want to face it, or else it can happen quickly.
It can. Well, again, call that 24/7 helpline because we can definitely help somebody through that crisis. And then hopefully come in and do a care plan after that. There are also other resources here within Minnesota. The Senior Linkage Line has a lot of resources also. And the two art organizations really work together to make sure that a person with the disease and their family has all the resources that are available in their community.
And there are even sometimes legal issues as well.
Oh, absolutely. And those are things that we're going to bring up. Hey, have you, you know, done a power of attorney? Do you, you know, what's going on with your finances? Have you talked about a living will? What are the things you need to do? So, you know, we don't do all of those things, but we can certainly give you a list of people that do and can help someone through that.
I guess, you know, just at the fundamental minimum, I guess that power of attorney can be pretty important.
Oh, extremely important. And, you know, important for all of us. We should have all these things set up ahead of time and have some of those really hard discussions with your loved ones, because what you don't want is for a person to have the disease and be too far gone or too far progressed that they don't get to help make those decisions. You know, if I asked you right now, Esme, you know, where would you want to live and who would you want to care for you as you were aging with dementia? You know, you want to be able to have input into that. And if you can no longer make those decisions or answer those questions, it becomes much more challenging for a family, because that's where then sometimes you have interesting family dynamics where one person will say, well, this is what mom would want. And someone else will say, no, this is what you should do.
I can see that as well. What are some of the more common questions you get about symptoms and what to watch for?
Well, you know, everybody will always say, oh, I can't remember anything anymore. Or, you know, I'm forgetting
my keys or
my keys, you know,
where I parked. Yeah.
And I always say, you know, that's normal. And there's a lot of normal aging signs. And you can look on our website and kind of know the 10 signs. It's right there. But what I always say is it's not that you lost your keys. It's that the keys are in your hand and you can't remember what to do with them. Or what they're for.
Okay.
You know, it's not that you, you know, you might get lost once in a while. You know, I come out of parking ramps and I can't figure out where I'm going. But it's, I'm driving the same way home I've done every day, and I might come to a stop sign and think, I have no idea where I am. You know, it's things
and
like that.
And it's that kind of a thing.
Yeah. It's not forgetting to pay a bill once in a while, but it's like regularly maybe paying bills twice. Or making irregular, irrational decisions about money. Actually, those financial ones and the balancing the checkbook are some of the first things to go. So those are important things to watch.
Wow. Okay. And in terms of somebody who's, you know, I imagine the financial things might be some of the most difficult, because that's something that obviously can have lasting impact if that gets
Absolutely.
Messed up.
Absolutely. Again, that's why we say it's so important to be diagnosed and to be diagnosed early so that there aren't big financial problems. And again, I would encourage everyone, whether you have dementia or think you might be facing dementia down the road, to look at that of how you want to live as you age, and so you can age well and have the financial resources that you need to live as long as you might.
Right. And that's, you know, as we talked about earlier, you know, people are living longer as well. What is there an average age of onset, or can it really vary?
It can really vary. So at age 65, it's 1 in 9 people have Alzheimer's disease. And at age 85, it's 1 in 3. But you can
oh my
have
goodness.
People in, yeah.
And when you say Alzheimer's, is that because you mentioned that sort of, does that include the dementia? The larger umbrella of dementia, or?
Yes.
One in three at age 85.
One in three, yes. But you can also have Alzheimer's disease at age 30, 40, 50. So, you know, it can hit anyone at any age.
And have those figures increased, or is it because the diagnosis is better now?
Well, again, it goes back to, you know, we're not dying of these other diseases. And so we are living longer and now it's more susceptible to Alzheimer's disease. But I do think our diagnosis is better. That's one of the things that our association works really hard, is to getting doctors to actually diagnose and tell people they have the disease. Because, you know, you can live well with this disease for a long time. I point out that, you know, when you get a diagnosis, you're not going to go into the nursing home tomorrow and probably be incapacitated. So how are you going to live with this disease? Okay. And, you know, that's what some of the things that we can do is give you those tools so that you can still live well.
Okay. Well, listen, Sue Spaulding, the CEO of the Minnesota North Dakota chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. Check out your website for some of this advice. Thank you so much for your input this evening.
Oh, thank you so much. We appreciate being part of this.
Absolutely. Do want to let you know that it is 656. The certified McCarthy's Cadillacs now up to 40% of MSRP. Shop McCarthyAuto.com. Really, a remarkable statistics here. At the age of 85, one in three people will have dementia or Alzheimer's. And there are a lot of people living to the age of 85 these days with the advances in medicine, as Sue mentioned, you know, with the advances against with all the other diseases. All right, folks, much more ahead. You can keep it here. You are listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.